This edition of the Optimize We podcast is brought to you by the Biohacking Index. Visit biohackingindex.com for ratings and reviews of your favorite wellness solutions and wellness providers.
This podcast is for informational purposes only. We are not medical professionals and do not provide medical advice. Consult a healthcare provider for any health concerns. Opinions expressed are not a substitute for professional medical guidance.
Hello and welcome to the Optimize We podcast, where we share biohacking truths and no BS ever. I'm Lindsay O'Neill. I'm your host. And today I am joined by one of my favorite people in the biohacking world. His name is Joseph Krieger. He is the president and founder of Boston BioLife. He has spent over 25 years, although he doesn't look like he spent over 25 years, in the healthcare and life sciences industry. And he is very well known in our side of the business for building what can be known as one of the best biohacking communities online and also in person at his events in Boston and around the country. So Joseph built Boston BioLife to help accelerate the integration of cutting-edge technologies into everyday medical practices. He works with over a couple hundred companies and these amazing cutting-edge technologies. So I think somewhere around 400, 450. And then he works with thousands of medical practices around the country and beyond. So welcome to the show, Joseph. How are you doing today?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me. This is very exciting to be able to communicate with you on your podcast and to be able to share some of the ideas that are currently swirling around in my brain regarding biohacking and life sciences and health and wellness in general.
Well, you always have a lot of really fun stuff swirling around in your brain, don't you?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the entertainment value of this. I mean, it's a controlled chaos, if you will, but I call it job security. Like, literally, ever is going to end because our most precious resources are health. And, you know, I think it's something we've put on the back burner or at least outsourced somewhere. And I think that's shifting and that's changing a lot of how we look at these things.
Joseph, you and I have talked several times, and it's always an amazing conversation. We always are ebbing and flowing because you and I are rooted in the same mission and vision, not just for our businesses, but also for our lives. Even though we come from very vast backgrounds, vastly different backgrounds, we have the same mission and vision for our businesses and for our lives. And that's really to connect the dots in this industry. This is a nascent stage industry. And eventually, in the course of this conversation, I want to get your opinion on what you think is next for biohacking. But to begin, let's start with your background. How the heck did you get into doing what you do right now?
Well, it's kind of a, I don't know how far back you want to go. I was born, in the 60s. So I was a little kid during Woodstock, Vietnam. And a lot of times, so I was surrounded by sex, drugs, and rock and roll, freedom of, life, and kind of a very, casual time. My mother was a nurse and my dad was an engineer and my brothers were all construction workers. So I actually grew up studying medicine as a very young age because there was medical textbooks all over my house, as well as chemistry kits and how to make bombs and ammunition and guns and slingshots and everything else you could think of, people working on cars. We had one of these homes that the doors were open. We never locked the door. I don't think the garage door went down. I don't think we had a lock. And people would come and go. So it was always this engaging. But I found a lot of intellectual solace in science, in medicine. And my mother was always teaching me. She became a nurse a few times in her life, and she was studying for her nursing exams. I think I was in the seventh grade, and I was literally her tutor. So I would sit and read medical textbooks with her, helping her. She had flashcards and everything else. And she got her nursing degree at 52. And it was funny because she would bring the girls from her classes home to meet her sons. She was graduated top of her class. Only 20 people graduated out of her, like 180. And she really put all her time and effort in. And she would say to me, you should be a doctor. You'll be a doctor. So I learned when I was like a teenager that if I tell everyone I'm going to be a doctor, then they don't bother you. Like when they say, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? If you say I'm going to be an artist or a musician, they'll be like, oh, don't do that. You'll never make a living. I'll be a history major. when you tell people you're going to be a physician, they're like, oh, that's great. So then somewhere along my life, I had to, oh my God, I have to become a doctor. So I went to UMass Amherst, very blue collar, you know, straight organization there. It was best college. I think it's one of the best collegiate values in the country. I paid $25. They accepted me immediately. All my friends went there and I went to UMass. So at UMass.
For $25?
No, it was only like $1,900 a semester, but it was $25 to get in. I filled out the form, gave the guy. Yeah. And they didn't even, you know, there was 13 of us from my class, and there was 13 to 15 people from all the grades around me. So the three grades, you know, behind me. So basically there was a 50 or 60 people that I knew from my hometown in Massachusetts at UMass. And I was pretty, you know, diligent about my work. I mean, it was a crazy place, and I would go to school from, you know, 8 to whatever every day and treat it like a job. So when I got back to the dorm and everybody was smoking weed and partying, freaking out, which were all my friends, and they all went 6 years. I had to get out of there in 4 years because I had to go to medical school. So I treated it like a job, and I did okay. I had a 3.8 in biochemistry. I had a blood alcohol content to match. I worked at the Belchertown State School at this thing called the Boltwood Project. You know, if you volunteer in certain things, and we help developmentally disabled people kind of with different things. We taught them sports, music. We danced with them. We took them on trips. And I have a certain passion for developmentally disabled people. It's kind of there, but for the grace of God, go I. And it was just really this, I took this project called the Boltwood Project, which had like 30 people in it. And by the time my friends were all done making fun of me in front of other people saying, guess what he does on Tuesday nights? You got a 2-credit A for doing this. And I needed to pad my cum because I wanted to get to medical school. Even with a 3.8, I barely got in. And all my friends ended up signing up because it was fun. And so we would go to Belchertown State School every Tuesday night. I did it for all 4 years, both semesters, and help these folks. And it was really a great way to kind of give back and to learn and to have fun, but also to appreciate your own health and wellness. So I've always kind of been on that path. When it became time to go to medical school, I didn't get in anywhere. Tulane, I think, is the only medical school that took me. And that was the week.
How many schools did you apply to?
Not too many, 5 or 6. I wanted to stay local. I wanted to stay in Boston. So like UMass Worcester. So I applied to BU Medical, PhD, MD program, Department of Biochemistry. They rejected me. And this is kind of an interesting story. Well, I took the rejection letter into the Department of Biochemistry to the chairman and, you know, asked to meet with him unannounced. And the lady let me sit down with him. And I had my cum and my letter. And I said, here's my transcripts and here's my letter. You know, he said, yeah, well, we only take 8 people from around the world. You know, it was a very select program. You have to be recruited and we have all these diverse students. And I'm like, well, I got to go to school. I mean, if I don't get a PhD or a master's degree in biochemistry, I'm going to be a laboratory. I'm going to be a dishwasher. You know, back then you could barely make 30 grand, 40 grand. You make 50 as a PhD. And so the guy, and we talked a little bit, he said, listen, you know, you have to be sponsored. And like literally back then you could smoke in buildings. This lady walks by smoking a cool and she said, I'll take them. And he said, well, there you go. And so this woman, Bernice Martin, became my professor. And I worked in a collagen and elastin laboratory. I did cytokines and growth factors. I was the tissue culture specialist. And that's how I got into medical school. I paid my own way. And the guy said, if you get A's and B's, you stay. If you get less than a B, I throw you out. I said, fine, I'll take the deal. And so when orientation came, all these students were there and they had these special designations, MD, PhD, and they were from Germany and India and France and China. And, all, you know, they all introduced themselves. And I'm so-and-so from Korea. And I said, I'm Joe Krieger. I live up Route 93 in Linfield. And so I wore a badge that says SS, special student. And everybody thought I was the genius. They're like, oh, who's that guy? He's the special student. I go, no, I'm on probation. I'm not even supposed to be here. I'm like trying to get in. I'm still trying to get in. So that's how I got into medical school. But what I learned in medical school, being a PhD, MD student, we all took the same classes, is the medical school students were so freaked out constantly. I'm going to fail. I'm not going to go there. So, you know, the day they had to pick where they were going to go, or they got told where they were going to go, it was like people crying, flipping out. I'm like, this is crazy. Like, why are they, and you're killing yourself. It's like 12 hours a day, 60. And the people that did well live with their parents. Those were construction. My mother had recently died when I graduated college. I didn't have, like, I was living with a bunch of guys, like college. I was working construction, trying to pull off this medical school thing. And so it was just a lot of different challenges. And so around 19, I was in 86. I went for 4 years. 90, I just dropped out and I got a job in the medical device field. doing surgical training. I created a surgical training program for interventional pain management for a 50-year-old medical device company called Radionix. They were the
And now this company, it was around for a long time, but when you came in, they didn't really have a strong sales team,
they didn't have anything. No, they were like, orders were going, and the international dealers had a joke, so the fax machine goes right into the trash can.
Oh my goodness. You know, I find that a lot about these biohacking companies. Even now, this is, you know, almost 30 years ago. You're talking about 1986, right? It's almost 30 years
ago. I was 92 when I started working in the...
No, that's a long time ago.
Right, 94, like we had just had a computer. Like we were just starting to do email.
Now, do you think it's because these guys who founded these companies are genius level people? They're doctors, scientists like you are. You're a rare breed because you're also a salesperson, which, you know, I know you're getting to in your story. But do you think it's because... like a lot of these tech companies now, these innovators, they're terrible at sales and marketing. Do you think that's because they just don't have that part of their brain that
teaches? It's hard to see the forest for the trees. I mean, when I went to Radionix, they had been around for 50 years. The mother was there. The father was there. The son had just left MIT to become the president. There was 30 people there. I mean, right. It was kind of I called it the Addams Family meets the Beverly Hillbillies. Because they were really weird and they had more money than God. And I came in as just kind of a blue collar guy and I realized that, you know, when I was a construction worker, if I knew everybody that wanted a deck or a roof or one of their house painted or their bathroom remodeled, I was very confident that if I knew who those people were, I could get that job because I could make them feel good about the process and figure out what they wanted to pick and get the deal. This company had leads falling out of their ears. People doing quotes, like, and I looked at the quote girl, like, what are all those things? She goes, these are quotes. I'm like, well, who's following? Nobody follows up. Like, you don't even follow up on them? No, they just come in. Okay, because they come in like 90 days. You'll get that order. I go, what if they're, if I'm your competitor, that's never coming in.
Right.
Because if St. Mary's is spending $70,000 on a stereotactic frame and I'm the rep in that territory, I know that purchasing agent, we're not even showing up.
Right.
I mean, we're lucky we're in business, but the company had a great reputation, and that's really what made the difference. And they, you know, they do $8 million. They have 20 people working for you. It's 80% margin. I don't think anybody was really worried.
No. You know, so they could have been doing so much more. And you came in and that's kind of low hanging fruit, right? They've got.
It was easy. I mean, honestly, people gave me a lot of credit for things like, yeah, I did amazing thing that I figured out. If you answer the phone and someone wants to buy something, sell it to them, you're a good salesman. No, a good salesman's making silk out of a sow's ear. A good salesman's someone beating the bricks and creating an opportunity. A good salesman's someone who like consults with a client to gain their trust or create a situation that ends up in a sale, right? You got to fabricate the process. And I think that being an order taker is great. I'd rather have the easier side of it, which is what I was fortunate, you know, really.
But you had really been in sales your whole life. You know, you'd been selling yourself your whole life. You were kind of born into this need to learn. And in order to get the things that you need, you had to sell yourself as someone who was capable of learning the things that you wanted to learn. And so
learning was an interesting thing, but for me too, because I was ADHD, still am. Like I said, I'm almost an AAD, almost a doctor, because I have ADHD. I wasn't able to make it, but kinetic learning, you know, people watch YouTube videos. If you show me how to do something, I can do it. If you make me read it, I'm probably going to miss a step.
I'm the same exact way. You know, I can't read to learn still in my 40s. And I know you're a little bit older than I am, but my kids are struggling with the same thing. And I actually think it makes us a little bit smarter because we can't look at something and understand it. We have to go the long way around and figure our way into a deeper level of understanding. But once we understand it, we never forget it. So how do you find these companies? How do you select the companies that you want to work with at Boston BioLife?
Well, kind of in a continuation of the evolutionary sense, when I started running hands-on training program for doctors, I mean, it was basically for the company that I worked for. We sold an RF generator. I got a bunch of cadavers in a hotel with C-arms. We taught the doctors how to place the needles to burn the medial branch, and that that revolutionized interventional pain. When I got into life science training and education in 2015, I started running training programs for spine in disc rejuvenation, so interdiscal biologics. One of my old friends messaged me on my birthday on Facebook, kind of an evolution of the technology. And he said, hey, I miss your cadaver courses. I got this new technology I want to run. And I had just set up Boston BioLab, but I thought I was going to teach doctors translational medicine, like CRISPR-Cas9, 3D printing, genetic engineering, you know, kind of more of the life sciencey stuff. And so we ran a cadaver lab for interdiscal biologics, and 88 people showed up, and I brought in a few companies. And so initially they were just who was there. I had no vendors, but I had 80 attendees, and I think I made 20 grand. So then I did another one, and then 88, 90 people showed up, and vendors were showing up at my meeting with checks saying, hey, $2,500, can I have a booth? I'm like, yeah, go over there. So the PRP company showed up, and then a company that made amniotic fluid showed up, and then a company, we sell lay aprons. All right, you can set up over there. So little by little, the companies came, because the trade show world was a little bit, you know, broken up, and a lot of competition, and people were looking for places they wouldn't have their competitor breathing down their neck. And we offered hands-on training, which is different than falling asleep in a lecture hall, right? Yeah. So that dynamic, that ADHD dynamic, which is the cornerstone of everything I've ever created. You're not going to sit in a dark room and listen to PowerPoint presentations until you nod off. I'm the worst. Yeah. If I sit in the front row, I fall asleep in 3 seconds. If I sit in the back, it's almost like hypnosis. I can stay awake because I see stuff in the room. It doesn't, you know, it's just a weird, but I make people get up, get into groups and try things. Like try the PRP kit. Learn. We harvested fat from cadavers in hotels because, and I think I was the first person to do that. How do you learn liposuction, right? If you're going to be an anesthesiologist or a pain doctor that wants to use fat, you're not a plastic surgeon. You don't ever taught you how to take this wand and pull 6 cc's of fat out of somebody's love handle. Right. So in all these technology, so the companies found me, I guess is the short answer.
All right. Well, we're going to have a big party.
That'll be a 10 year. Should do it back in Boston, November 15th in Boston. We ran the first interventional pain. What was it called? It was stem cells and biologics for the clinical applications of degenerative disc disease. So interdiscal biologics.
That's a mouthful. Try to say that.
It's still a thing. How about percutaneous interventional orthobiologic for the clinical applications of musculoskeletal medicine? There's a mouth.
Goodness.
That's your worth of biologics, right? So you take an ultrasound and you take a needle and you stick it to joint and you put in a stem cell. That's image-guided interventional orthobiologics. And that's...
I like how you made it very simple, that long, complicated. And I'm very grateful that you didn't make me say that on camera. I appreciate that. But so you have all of these companies, they're coming to you, they're literally bringing you checks, which is pretty much every small business owner. You just launched this business. Like, I would love to manifest that for Wellness Eternal.
Yeah.
But you have all of these companies. How do you discern between the good ones and the not so good ones? How do you really get down to the dirty details so that you can ensure that you're not training these doctors on stuff that's crap?
Sure. I mean, you know, like I said, I'll put my toes to the line, go right up to Crazyville and look over the edge, because you're not willing to explore the boundaries of what we know and what we understand. And it's different now, because when you're in a surgical intervention, you know, you grab a device and you do something to a joint or a shoulder or something. And when you're in life sciences, you're dealing on a cellular thing. So you don't get to see, like, does the mitochondria do this? Or does the phospholipid membrane do this? Are we stimulating or activating some protein synthesis? It's hard to know, right? And so all these technology, but it basically, you look at peer-reviewed studies. Are there studies to support the efficacy? Things, you know, FDA approval doesn't always fall in line, but it's not a bad barometer. Do you have any efficacy? I mean, can you show anecdotal evidence, real-world evidence? Does it work? So I say, does it work and can we prove it? And typically, a lot of these things have legacy, their history, they have historical significance that they've been abandoned because of traditional medicine, lack of evidence, regulatory blockades.
I'm actually surprised to hear you say that FDA is a good benchmark, because I really always thought the FDA was kind of more pay to play, just like everybody else in, you know, promotion.
I think they're defensive. I think they're defensive and they get away with it because there's no harm in ever saying, I want to make sure you're absolutely safe. But when they're absolutely safe about something else, they're allowing all these other things to proliferate that perhaps we don't know how safe they are.
Right.
We don't know with a lot. Like, for example, let's just look at joint replacement. You know, you can't walk, your knee hurts, you go to a doctor, he x-rays your knee, and he says, oh, you're bone on bone, and you need a bilateral knee replacement. And you're like, oh, gee whiz. And I can't tell you the number of people I've steered away from this, and I only do it because they ask me, what do you think? I say, talk to this guy, because if he says you don't need it, you don't need it.
Right.
Because he's one of the leading orthobiologics doctors. And these people are everywhere. There's 7,000 physicians in this country that claim to be a PRP or a, you know, orthobiologics, who are going to try to do everything. Yeah, if you look at the Orthopedic Biologic Society on LinkedIn, they're all there. And they're still fighting over what percentage of leukocytes and PRP or bone marrow, this and that. But the point is, they're trying to restore the joint without ripping it out. You can always rip it out, right?
Right.
You can always do, and if you go too early, like before you're 50, you're going to have a revision. So what's really going to suck is when you're 70 and they're trying to haul this thing out of your femur that's been in there for 10 years because it failed. And I always say there's way better stuff coming. So the longer you can wait within reason, the more you know within reason, people have to become their own advocate. But the FDA is not going to approve, you know, stem cell therapy for joint replacement. So that what happens is the joint replacement market proliferates. It grows because of the lack of competition, because there are no viable alternatives. And it's really buyer beware.
We really got to get this message out there. So my fiance, I think I told you, he's a FDNY lieutenant. He was injured in a fire and he dislocated his shoulder for the second time in a fire. The stair broke and he went headfirst down a flight of stairs, grabbed the railing and dislocated his shoulder. But it was a shoulder that he had previously dislocated in 2010, I think. And he has tons of arthritis. So the doctor doesn't want to tighten it up, right? Because what will that do to the arthritis? It'll just exacerbate the issue. And so he won't be able to really move his arm or his shoulder at all without a significant amount of pain. So, and he's too young, he's 45. So he's not going to get a shoulder replacement surgery, to your point, because then he'll have to have a revision when he's, you know, maybe 65. And if luckily he lives into his late 90s, he's going to be without a shoulder. Because you can only do one revision surgery. You can only have one revision after having a joint replaced. So, but his doctor is, you know, one of the head doctors at HSS, and he's one of the doctors for the New York Giants. He's an amazing doctor. But, you know, they can't recommend that he goes and does PRP, right? He can't recommend that he takes some sort of stem cell therapy or do any sort of like fringe up at the toe at the line therapy. And it's a shame, because there's a lot of stuff that's out there, and that's the intention of this podcast. And I know that that's a huge portion of what you're enthusiastic about with Boston BioLife.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because stem cells are one of these catch-all things, but they really represent an area of medicine. They're very poorly understood. It's the words that people use, getting cells to regenerate, the management of inflammation, repair and replace is the existing biological process, right? So in the world of like Hospital for Special Surgery, and there's a guy named Greg Lutz there who does the interdiscal stuff, and he's somebody you should talk to. I also have Jock Farrell in Maryland, who your boyfriend should go, your fiance should go see, because he's the guy that I send people to. He's one of the world's leading sports restoration physicians. He works with the Washington Wizards. He works with the Washington soccer team. He teaches for the orthobiologics communities. And again, and he has clinics all over that area. But if he says that there's nothing he can do, then, you know, you're kind of moving in the different direction. But I'm willing to bet. But there's just a lot of nuances to what they call regenerative medicine. PRP is fairly well established. But PRP, people think, is a stem cell therapy. It's not. It's an anti-inflammatory therapy. Cytokines and growth factors that come from the platelets are really there to help facilitate healing. Nothing will heal if it's inflamed. So if you look at the circle of healing, inflammation is the first component of the acute phase response. You injure yourself, all the interleukins come out, it signals inflammatory response, everything swells, and that's really the body's way of protecting the joint and giving it, bathing it, or nurturing it until whatever. So when that inflammation is finally removed, and that's what PRP does, now the endogenous stem cells can start to activate and start to repair. Nothing will repair when it's inflamed, and that's actually a theme for all diseases. chronic inflammation, chronic systemic inflammation is the root cause of every single disease on the face of the earth known to man, period, end of story. I will challenge the world's leading thought leaders on this concept. And it, for the most part, it's based on the immune system's response to foreign invaders in our bloodstream, primarily which are introduced through some microbiome deficiency, either the mouth, the intestine, or the stomach.
Well, just don't say that on your TEDx, because that's the reason why my TEDx wasn't published.
Well, it's published
privately.
The cat's out of the bag in a lot of ways, because people get this, right? And they may have learned it a million different ways. They may have come into this from a different direction. But those concepts aren't that as foreign as they were 5 years ago.
Well, and there's a lot of research to back it up now. And I think that there's going to be a tidal wave of research that's coming out now with all of this, you know, post-viral inflammatory issues like long COVID and other stuff that we're all experiencing at a mass level now, which used to be a smaller amount of people actually experienced inflammation in their body with pain and autoimmune and that kind of thing. And now autoimmune is way on the rise. And a lot of people don't realize that cancer is an inflammatory disease.
Pre-diabetes is long-term malingering systemic inflammation.
Correct.
But an important point I want to make, you know, just because of who your audience is and what I think, just because something's not proven in peer-reviewed research doesn't mean it works. Doesn't mean it doesn't work, okay? And just because someone says this works the way we think it does, doesn't mean it's true. People can say they're a stem cell therapy or the body's is increasing endogenous, you know, stem cells from hemopoiesis, which is the manufacturing of red blood cells. But maybe what that thing's doing is not doing that. Maybe it's creating an anti-inflammatory response, which is facilitating healing. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. Maybe it doesn't work the way that the person thinks it works.
Right.
Right. So there's a fine line between understanding the mechanism of something and understanding, like, the indigenous people through millennia, every culture has understood plant botanicals. They don't know what the mechanism of action is when they chew on saffron and it does this, or they eat this root and it does that. They just know that historically the Chinese have done this and a lot of Asian cultures have known this. How do they learn what they know, right? Passed down through centuries and generations. And so what we understand, so what I'm saying is, someone tells you something works, have an open mind. Man, don't blindly trust that what they say is how it worked, but that doesn't matter necessarily, because if there's enough evidence to support that people get better from, like, a traumatic brain injury or they have arthritis, you know, look at things like balance of nature. You know, it's like you take fruits and vegetables, you get, but we're animals.
Right.
You know, it's not really that hard. The problems are complicated. The solutions are not that complex. Fresh air, sunshine, exercise, nutrition, love, sense of purpose, move around. I don't think that, you know, we get wrapped up in the complexity of our issues and thinking that this is some insurmountable thing, and it's not. It's really simple.
Well, it's also such a dichotomy too, right? Because in the other side of medicine, in the pharmaceutical side of medicine, I worked in pharmaceutical advertising for a long time until 2019, actually. So until a fairly recent time frame. And when you work in advertising, the thing that you have to be the most careful of is what you say in that ad, right? Because the purpose, the intention, is to have the person who is looking at that ad or listening to that ad, whatever form the ad is in, go and tell their doctor, hey, I need X medication, right? But do you really research that medication? Just as you would with stem cell therapy or something that's, like, a little bit more fringe, you know, like light therapy or hyperbaric oxygen therapy or any of these biohacking modalities, which are not necessarily proven. No, you don't. You don't look into that medication. And I know for a fact, working with these pharmaceutical companies, because I actually used to be an advisor to the New York Times around pharmaceutical advertising and which ones were more efficacious and which ones weren't. I was kind of like their healthcare advisor for a couple of years. And what I found was their health tech advisor. What I found was a lot of these big pharmaceutical companies, when they're doing their clinical studies, they don't have statistical significance. And I'm a data person, right? I'm not a scientist like you are, and I'm not a doctor, but I know a lot about data and regression analysis and making sure that you have statistical significance in data so that you can have confidence and in your theory that it is going to work the way that you say it's going to work. I would say a lot of these medications are coming out without that statistical significance. I know for a fact that a medication that was intended to help prevent suicide, it was a ketamine-driven medication, it didn't get the amount of people that they needed in the clinical study for statistical significance. But guess what? It still got it FDA approved. And it's on the market now. And I think it's great, because I think it's great that a ketamine product to help people with severe depression and suicidal thoughts is on the market, because I know for a fact that ketamine therapy can work in some people.
Yeah, and it will benefit somebody. See, I think the key point you just made there, it's not a one-size-fits-all. So if you go look at the statistical significance of any clinical trial, you're going to find people that got remarkable results. But typically, if it doesn't affect 100,000 people or you don't have enough percentage, it won't pass the litmus test. That's why you have all these off-label drugs or non-intended drugs, like metformin, was diabetes and cures cancer. So you have all these different things. But personalized precision medicine is changing all that. No clinical trial is truly a randomized, placebo-controlled, multi-center clinical trial, because no patients are the same. You may have the same clinical indication. You have type 2 diabetes. You have, you know, Alzheimer's. You have Parkinson's. Even things like cystic fibrosis or MS, they have multiple deleterious gene mutations, meaning they're not the same disease. So it's not what disease does the patient have. It's what patient does the disease have. That's the essence of personalized precision medicine. So things like genetics, genomics, and proteomics and metabolomics, the individual signatures of each person really drive which drug they'll respond to. So the problem with a Saturday afternoon, you need Keytruda added to your Abilify, added to your whatever, because that drug didn't work, so try this drug, now pile this one on. Now you have these multiple neurocognitive, you know, drugs that take a long time to work. They take a long time to figure out psychotropic that they don't work. And that's why we have so many freaked out, depressed people in this country, that because we're so quick to put them on something, especially the kids. I don't chastise traditional medicine, because lifespans have doubled, cancer rates have fallen, new technologies. Look at minimally invasive surgery versus open surgery, radiation oncology versus whole body radiation. There's been massive evolution, heart-lung machine, you know, and ventricular. And I'm a fan of surgery. I'm a fan of the history of surgery. I think it's amazing. George Washington died of bloodletting.
He did.
He bled out because he had an infection. That wasn't that long ago. People still use leeches in wound care, all right? But they're cloning monkeys in Korea. So when someone says, like me, where are the flying cars? Like, what is the most impressive thing you've seen in healthcare? Well, it's the lack of adoption of what's happening in a lab to clinical practice, like Gavin Newsom.
You said so much stuff, but there's such a dichotomy. There, you know, it's easy adoption for anything that is medically driven, right? That is Western medicine, that is prescribed. Anyone will tell you 9 times out of 10, if my doctor tells me to do it, I say okay. But your doctor is a human being, and your doctor doesn't always make the right decisions. You have to be your own doctor. You have to be your own advocate. You have to be your own research analyst. You have to be your own data regression analysis analyst.
Physicians need to be more scientific, and patients need to be more physician oriented. Person, you have to be your own, you know, patient advocate. Let the buyer beware. Trust but verify.
Yeah,
you know, understand.
If you go into a doctor's office and they give you a pill for every ill, say, okay, well, what will this pill do specifically to me? In the particular disease that I'm in,
do a genetic metabolism test to see which type of metabolizer you are. Very simple. Like, I'm not saying that there's 1,000 shades of gray, but there's 4 buckets: high, medium, low, or no. You can tell if somebody's going to respond to something pretty much pretty quickly, and they shouldn't. You know, where are the adverse events? That's why if you look at the, you know, any pharmaceutical commercial, it's like, oh, try this drug, you know, Keytruda or whatever they are, Then you hear a year later, if you or a loved one ever took this pill, call the law firm of Dewey, Cheatham & Happ, right?
Man.
Because what they do is they take a percentage of the billions that they make and they set it aside for the adverse events. it's baked into the formulary of the pill.
Right.
But all they really have to do is to see if that patient is a good candidate. And maybe it's just an evolution of medicine, and that's what'll happen going forward. Like, you shouldn't take it. They have their symptoms, their side effects. You have watery eyes and this, that, and the other thing, right? That's the, yep. the what could happen to you. So they kind of warn you. I wouldn't touch any of those things. And we make up these things like the rule of decades. You're allowed to be on as many pills as decades you're old.
I know that.
I mean, people look at me and go, what's wrong with you? It's like, you're not on any pills. I'm like, yeah, I know. Well, I mean, give me a little bit of time, but still.
Well, you're still young, but also you're doing all the things right. And I love what you said about it's not the, you know, what disease does the patient have? It's what patient does the disease have? And I think that is, you know, the personalized precision medicine is such a, it's such a fine tuning point for doctors to think about, but it's mind blowing. And I really think that the whole healthcare industry, and especially the whole biohacking industry, is going to pivot on that particular point.
You pick those are the customer of healthcare. They're the ones with the health insurance. They're the ones that have to be able to demand a certain amount of attention. We've been trained to outsource our most precious resource to a stranger who knows nothing about us and to believe that we're somehow not capable of understanding the complexity of medicine, although we're the ones living in the body, right?
Right.
People, oh, don't confuse your symptoms with my four-year medical degree. Don't connect your four-year medical degree with how I feel. Right? People know a lot more. So we're computer programmers, we're engineers, we're scientists, we drive heavy equipment, we program things, but yet we're not capable of understanding something like the immune system. I get it, it's complicated, but it's not more complicated than flying a jet or going to the or even driving a backhoe. So the guy that doesn't think he can figure out his metabolism because some doctor, you know, he's a construction worker, I bet you'd be surprised at when patients become a little bit more aware and more engaged, more educated, that the outcomes go up because they're taking responsibility. They're not just responding to what they're told. And that's patient engagement. And it really is an important part. But I think we got to break the cultural norm that we're not qualified to know how we feel or why.
Well, they're also kind of keeping us stupid in some ways, right?
Well, people accept it, though. People are like, oh, the doctor has to tell me. Is like, I don't trust my I went to 7 hernia surgeries before I found the robotic guy. Everybody was cut me open. And I said, no way. And I'm fighting into these surgeries. I'm like, go through my belly button, come up here, encephalate this, go over there and do that. The guy goes, how do you know this? I'm like, listen, this isn't that hard. You shouldn't have to gut me like a fish to fix a little hole in my stomach.
Worst patient ever. You're the best worst patient.
Guy's like, oh, I could do that, but I don't want to. Here, talk to my friend. He might try it. I talked to that guy. He's like, I don't want to do that. So finally, I called the Da Vinci robot guy by accident. He's like, I've been doing this for 20 years. I'd had it under in COVID. It was great.
Wow. That's amazing.
I just three little holes in my stomach. It looks like I fell down and landed in a bush or something. Like I got poked with a stick. You can't even see it.
Don't make jokes about that. I did that while hiking. I fell into a cactus without my hands. They shattered my tailbone and broke my sacrum in half. And it took my mom all of like 4, maybe 5 hours to take all the prickers out of my behind. But I digress. So, yes, I didn't have to have surgery.
I did. Well, think about it, though. So, like, if I wasn't a skeptic, I've sat in a lot of ORs and watched a lot of doctors look at me like, oh, am I in the right spot? And I'm like, that's pretty scary. I was a construction worker 90 days ago. Now I'm guiding you to putting an electrode at the globus pallidus interna of the brain. But sure. No, I think you need to be move over a little bit.
People don't give themselves enough credit. And it's a common theme in all of these podcasts is that, you know, you don't have to spend a fortune. You don't have to be a life scientist or a biologist or a rocket scientist or a data scientist or any sort of medical professional or have even read a peer-reviewed article like you are. You know, there are just normal questions that you can ask. There are things that you can do, like just sitting there and saying like, okay, how do I feel? I just took this pill,
yeah.
Right? How is it making me feel? Mm. You know, maybe wait 4 hours. It's just the same thing I do with food inflammation diets, right? So I do a blood test. It tells you what foods are causing an inflammatory reaction in your body.
Yep.
You take out those foods, and then you don't want to take out those foods forever because maybe it's a food you really love, right? Like my fiance had coffee at the top of his list. He's a fireman. You think he can avoid coffee after doing a 24-hour shift in the fire department? No. So like coffee is life for them, even though he's taking his methylene blue and doing all the other things and, you know, dry brushing, getting his lymphatic, he needs coffee. So what do? We test, right? We test. He drinks some coffee and then he sits there and he sees how he feels. And if he's got some bubbles.
Do you think it's the coffee or do you think it's the, like the, you know, when people talk about coffee beans, they got mold or something on them or they got this.
I don't know. Coffee may have been a bad example, but like I have bananas at the top of my list. And I know if
I know what I have. I've never even looked. See, that's the thing. I'm not a really good biohacker. I believe first year sunshine and exercise get you 80% of the way. And it's not what you do. It's what you like unforced errors. Don't drink Mountain Dew. All right. McDonald's never. Dunkin' says America runs on Dunkin's. It's like, no shit.
Yeah.
Go to Walmart on Sunday afternoon and just watch the people walking by.
Yeah.
We're a morbidly obese society, and it's terrible, especially with certain ethnicities. They're responding to the additives. Our food is killing our immigrants.
It really
is. They are not prepared. These people that have been coming into this country for the last 5 years from everywhere are now eating these American diets, and they're just blowing up like crazy because their body can't handle the process, whatever, and the nitrates and the gluten.
Because look at where they're coming from, right? Like if you look at these other countries where they're eating vegetables out of their backyard, they're eating raw milk from the cow or the goat that's on their farm or in their neighbor's farm. They're eating eggs straight from the chickens that are laying them all over the roads, the dirt roads. They're grounding. They're getting outside. They're getting vitamin C. No, but I mean, seriously. They
eat fish from the ocean.
People are coming to the United States and they want to live the American dream. And that includes McDonald's and it includes
diet disease.
It's terrible. It's called the sad
but
diet.
I'm also believing that they're more ethnically, susceptible. There's a genetic predisposition. I mean, I without being stereotypical or nothing I say is intended to be the least bit discriminatory. You said, look at Latin women, young Latin women. They're like their body morphologies, their skeletons aren't even given a chance. That's why no clothes are normal. Everything's elastic. I mean, even the clothing industry has learned to put, stretchy clothes. Everybody stretches. And we don't have normal body morph. Go look at a picture of people from the 50s on a beach. None of them are fat. And it's sad because they don't have it's an unforeseen, danger that.
But if you go to those Latin American countries, they don't look the same as they do here in the United States.
Even in Europe, people like Dad, that's where you go to Europe, they eat butter and croissants, and they say, because it's healthier there.
Right. I went to Paris.
He talks about like European food and how much healthier it is in the U.S.
It's amazing. I can
get it. Why does the U.S. do what it does? It's under the guise of safety. Someone says, I'm keeping you safe. Here's Blake glyphosate all over your GMO. Corn or whatever.
Right. Well, now Roundup apparently doesn't have glyphosates in it, but it has 45 other things that apparently are even more toxic and worse for our bodies than,
Here's the thing. All is not lost, because if it was as bad as we think it is, and it's pretty bad, how are we able to live into our 70s, 80s, and 90s despite it all, right? So it's really a testimony to how strong your immune system is, how adaptive your biology is, how effective some of these things. And people don't think walking. I used to laugh at the people walking. Look at that guy. He's on the elliptical. I'm lifting weights thinking I'm some big shot. I play hockey every day, whatever, like killing myself. And then I hurt my arm. I was lifting a mattress and I ripped my bicep tendon. And it was like brutal. And I couldn't lift. So guess where I went? On the elliptical. And then I was thinking, I'm dropping weight. Now I'm walking. I walked an hour a day for a year. I lost 35 pounds.
Wow.
And it was like pleasurable. It was like, wow, this is cathartic. I'm walking. And then it became like every good, addict. I got addicted to walking every day with it's 20 below zero. I'm out walking. And it was like, what are you doing? I'm like, I can't not do it. And people don't realize it's simplicity. You know, it's not always what you do, it's what you don't do. And I think that that's why it's not hard, I guess, is my takeaway. Start somewhere. Create a metric that you can live by, whether you want to lose weight or quit a habit or, and you know, if you don't want to do it for yourself, do it for your family. We all these, and there's a ton of apps. There's 300,000 apps out there that can help you. I think electronic or appification or gamification is a cool thing to do. Be with others, be with peers, you know, find resources around you, groups that you can join. Look, not everybody takes the same whatever, B vitamin or glutathione or metformin or rapamycin. So find stuff that you like and try it and just begin somewhere.
Yeah. And it's, just starting is something that I've told every single one of my clients and probably not practiced it enough myself. It's one of those things where we're afraid, we don't know where to start. And that's really the intention of everything that you're doing. Everything, that's the intention of everything that I'm doing too with this podcast, because people don't know where to start. They don't know what thing to do. And going outside and getting sunlight first thing in the morning and taking your shoes off and grounding in the earth and drinking clean water and breathing fresh air and maybe taking...
walking in the forest, going to the beach.
Right.
Clearing your mind. Get away from electronic stimulation.
All sound great. But at the end of the day, Joe, we've all got responsibilities. We've got bills to pay. We've got kids to take care of. We've got, you know, elderly parents to care for. And we sometimes end up putting ourselves last. And I think that all boils down to that big point that you made earlier. We don't feel worthy. We don't feel valuable enough or like we know enough to make better decisions in our life.
So we don't really appreciate the long-term consequences of like having a full-time job is a death sentence.
Right.
I retired when I retired in 2008 and, you know, I played semi-pro hockey at 48 years old. I was a practice goalie for the Eastern Professional Hockey League. Now, was it because I was a great goaltender? No, I was sitting around at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. These 23-year-old kids wanted to shoot a puck at something. So they said, come on down. And I, for 5 years, I played with these guys and, you know, it helped my game. I played really well. I got better. And, you know, it was exhausting, but it was like the things I did because I didn't have a job or I chose not to work after a certain point in time. I wanted to spend time with my kids. I felt like, you know, be locked in a building. When the Gmail phone came out, I was free. I could consult. I created courses for people. I was able to do things I wanted, but I went to the gym. I walked, I played hockey. I volunteered. I studied religion. I looked at spirituality. I learned mindfulness. Not good at it, but I read a bunch of books and learned, you know, things that, you know, that maybe there's more to what we think than we know or we see, right? And the process, the long term, you like, you don't think time's going by? Like a full 5 years go by. Go look at a picture of yourself 10 years ago. Go look at a picture of someone else 10 years ago. You know, we change a lot in 10 years. And guess what? 10 years will be here before you know it. And you can do things on a small scale every day now, knowing that every day a day goes by. And look, in 30 days, you'll know. In 60 days, people that know you will know. In 90 days, everyone will know. Whether it's weight loss or exercise or something to make yourself look better. And I think that all of those theories, strategies, anecdotes, you know, are all there to help you. And really, whatever you find what works for you and just build on it just a little bit.
Joseph, I'm so grateful that you were able to come onto the podcast today because you've taught me so much about being an advocate for myself. You've really inspired me to take the next step in what I need to do in order to optimize my health and to be more discerning. I'm that data nerd that always wants to look at what's the truth versus what's the BS. But you're absolutely right. It's all bio-individual to me. What works for somebody else may not work for me. I'm just so grateful for your time, your energy, and all that you're doing with Boston BioLife and beyond. And I'm thrilled for this episode to come out because it's very educational, it's very inspirational, and it's very tactical in a very easy way. It just tells you to just do one little small hinge change, because small hinges swing the big door of positive change. You don't have to change everything. Don't get overwhelmed. You know, don't get down on yourself. Just start. So thank you for that.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you, Lindsay. We look forward to our next encounter.
Yeah. Can't wait.